This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Do you believe in ghosts? The way they're portrayed in movies and on TV makes them seem a little bit silly, just like this clip from the 1984 classic Ghostbusters.
Don't move. It won't hurt you.
Slimed me.
That's great! Actual physical contact!
Okay, well, it turns out real-life ghost busting is a far cry from the movies. Two of our next guests investigate paranormal activity in the real world and all around North Carolina. Nelson Noss is the executive director and co-founder of the Ghost Guild Incorporated. His research team travels to some of the spookiest places in the state to collect data and debunk ghost stories. Nelson, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a pretty busy time of year for a paranormal investigator, I'm guessing.
It is. We get a lot of requests, because everyone is looking for spooky stories and things like that. So, yeah, we definitely get a lot of. And also, we do presentations with libraries, and yeah, so it's definitely a busy time of the year.
So tell us, what is a paranormal investigation? Kind of walk us through what it actually looks like.
We typically start by trying to get an idea of some of the paranormal reports that have occurred at that particular location. And then we try to go in and actually find rational explanations for those happenings. And you don't want to just automatically go to the conclusion that something that happened is paranormal. And there's normally always a good explanation for what has been reported.
So are you trying to disprove what people think is happening? Or kind of do you have any kind of intention when you go into these spaces?
It's hard. So when we go into these places, they're not controlled environments. And so you really can't walk out of a place, even if you had something you can't explain, you can't say really that it's paranormal because it's not a controlled research space, right? So we try to collect as much data as we can. And again, trying to determine, is there another explanation that can be determined from it? And if not, then we try to see if by going back multiple times, you can try to test different theories and try to see if they're, if you had something that happened, could it have been air conditioning? Could it have been other environment variables that, again, are out of our control?
And so you are working in some of these spaces in North Carolina that have a really rich history. Maybe take us to one of them, the USS Wilmington, the battleship.
The battleship, yes.
Yeah.
We actually visit the battleship, I'd say, a minimum about two times a year, although I did spend the night on that ship seven times last year. And we purposely rent the ship the nights of the Azaleas Festival and the Riverfest Festival. And the reason why we do that is because they have fireworks across the Cape Pure River on those days. And we find that most of the nights of those fireworks is when we have the most activity. And we think it's because when you're in the ship, the sounds of the fireworks kind of is a trigger for some of the
activity. Sounds like you're in battle.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we've had some interesting things happen that
what
we still haven't
have you
been
had
able.
Happen?
We've actually, in the sick bay area, we've had bed springs that you could hear the bed springs being hit, and they're like, kind of bouncing back and forth. So there was a lot of force behind that. And that we haven't been able to explain. And we know that we try to control as much as we can. We know where everyone is on that ship. And we know that there was only two people in that particular location at that time. So that was definitely an interesting thing. I mean, it's not something where wind could have come in and just made. I mean, it was a clear hit onto the bed springs. And then you hear them reverbing back and forth for a few times.
So when you say you know where everyone is, you all as a team have everything really clearly mapped out. We'll be in this place for this many minutes, then we'll move, so that any of these unexpected noises, you can definitely say this was not one of our team members because we knew exactly where they were.
Correct.
Okay.
We have a very strict schedule that we follow. And and we also set it up that way because we want to make sure that we don't have anyone that's close enough that you can contaminate each other's data.
Okay.
By hearing their voices in the background or something like that.
Well, so, tell me about your own experience with the paranormal. I know you had an experience as a young kid, but then you had another one more recently since you've been doing these investigations that ended up involving your daughter down the line. Will you tell us that story?
Yeah. So this was following a visit to Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, which is located in West Virginia. We spent the night there, and one of the reports was that there was a little girl named Lily that haunts one of the rooms. And one of the things we try to do when we try to interact with any potential spirit activity or spirits that are in that particular location is try to make it a personal thing. We're not just there to ask questions and hope they're just going to answer us. We try to relate personally to them. So the only thing I could think of was to talk about my daughter. And I shared with Lily, you know, what my daughter liked to do. Then I asked her, well, what do you like to do? And so it's kind of that trying to get some back and forth. I didn't think much about it after that, but I left and I came back home. And shortly after coming back home, my daughter started waking up at night in fear, scared. And it took me several nights to finally get her to tell me what she was seeing. And she said there was a little girl.
Had you told her about the experience that you had just known?
I had completely forgotten about that. And I was like, okay, a little girl. And even then I hadn't connected anything. And when I asked her more information about the little girl, she wouldn't say anything. But a few more nights later, I asked her, well, what's this girl's name? And her response was Illy. So I, at that point in time, started putting two and two together, and I decided to sage the room. I had a little chat with Lily, telling her that this was not an invitation for her to come and see my daughter. And it has been no problem since.
Wow. So I think with these stories, what's so interesting is that if you have not had one of these experiences yourself or have someone close to you who's had one, you may hear the story and think, this guy is totally nuts. What is he talking about? How do you respond to people that may be sitting in their car thinking that right now?
That's absolutely fine. I'm not doing this to try to prove to anyone else. I'm actually in this trying to find answers for what I encountered as a child. Mm. So, and we purposely never present anything that we capture as evidence. Like I said, we don't have a controlled environment, so we can't say that it's evidence. It's just data. And we like for people to, you know, kind of view it that way and keep a critical mindset. And again, thinking, what are other possibilities?
Okay, I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now. Nicole Morock is the Vice President of the National Society of Paranormal Investigation and Research. She's also the author of Please Don't Call Me Psychic, Stories from My Paranormal Life. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you are an empath. You are not a psychic. What is an empath?
An empath is somebody who can literally feel what others are feeling, whether it be physical or emotional. And I think we all have a bit of an empath. As far as our abilities go, we have those abilities, but some of us stay a little more in tune to them when we're children and we have experiences. Our parents will say, well, you know, it's nice that you understand that, or she's the sensitive type, or along those lines. Or if they're extreme experiences, that was just your imagination. Mm. And then as you get older, if you listen to those that's just your imagination and you believe it, you kind of lose touch with the ability to feel these things. I was stubborn, so I'm still able to. So I could stand next to somebody with a physical ailment and feel it myself, or I could walk into a place with a spirit presence and feel that presence. I'm also intuitive, so I get things, information that I should not otherwise know. And somehow it just comes to me.
So unlike Nelson and his team who go into these historic places around the state, you actually will go into people's homes.
I will. And I've also gone to the historic places. Our group has done the Battleship and Mordecai as well. But I prefer residential and even businesses. If people say, we're afraid to be here, can you help us? Then I'm very quick to say, yes, we'll come in and do what we can. We still approach it with a healthy dose of skepticism, because if you're not using your critical thinking skills, you're doing a disservice to everybody involved.
Okay, so most people are reaching out to you because of fear, would you say, more so than curiosity, or some blend?
A lot of times it's fear. Sometimes it is just, I think my house is haunted, could you come validate it for me? And sometimes they're disappointed because we come in and we actually debunk everything and say, you know, we don't really see anything that tells us that this is haunted. But other times we go in and we have our own personal experiences and we capture electronic voice phenomena, and we come out and we may not say it's haunted, but we say, here are the anomalies and here are the experiences we had. You can put whatever label on this, but there is something going on here.
So when you are in these spaces, for both of you, what kind of tools are you using? How do you actually measure what you think is paranormal activity? Maybe start with you, Nikki.
Okay. So I tend to first use my own sensitivity. If we go into a place and I feel like there's something in a specific location, I always start with a cold walkthrough. So I try not to be told anything about the location first. I'll do a cold walkthrough, say what I'm feeling and where, and then we sit down and find out whether or not there's any validation to what I've just said. And then when we bring the whole team in for a full investigation, most of the time we'll use an EMF detector to get a baseline reading.
What's EMF?
Electromagnetic frequencies.
Okay.
To get a baseline reading of where there's maybe some stronger electromagnetic frequencies and fluctuation. Like, not because we think that has anything to do with ghosts. It's a lot more if there is something strong like that near somebody's head while they're sleeping, it can induce hallucinations and nightmares.
Okay, so you're actually trying to control for whatever electromagnetic activity may already be happening
exactly.
in the house.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we use some photography, but it's so easy to fake photography that we don't rely on it too much. And we always have our digital voice recorders, and that's where we get most of the anomalies that we can then say, okay, we have some data, and we can play it back for you. So we get the voices caught on tape that you don't hear while you're sitting there most of the time. I mean, most of the time you don't hear it.
And can you sense a difference between energy that is positive and negative, as in someone who maybe is existing in a space because something bad happened to them there, versus someone who's there to kind of, you know, protect their family or oversee whatever
yes.
it is?
Yes, I can get positive, negative, neutral, sad, excitable, angry, you know, this is the same emotions that everybody feels. I can pick up on them. And that helps us get a sense of, okay, is this something that if the family does say, okay, obviously there's a spirit here, can you clear it out? Then, you know, the negative ones are the ones you're more likely to want to clear out. If they say, you know, it's my great Aunt Bessie, please don't get rid of her, we're just going to leave it at that.
So Nelson, what makes some spaces more likely to be haunted or home to paranormal activity than others, would you say?
Oh boy, that's a hard one. There's definitely different theories around what causes a location to be haunted. Especially a lot of people think, like, why is it always historical locations, for example? My personal beliefs on that is just that you tend to have more of, back then you used to have more of a connection to your home. I mean, you worked hard, you built it yourself, perhaps even. It was a place that you had your family, you know, it was a place you lived your entire life. Unlike now, a home is just a commodity. You move from one to the other. You don't have as strong as an attachment to the location. So I do think that that's one of the reasons why potentially, you know, there's more reports of hauntings in historical locations. You see a lot of places like the old asylums or old hospitals. There's certainly been a lot of things that have happened in those locations that could cause some residual, you know, activity to happen there. But everything's a theory. We just don't know for certain why a place is more haunted than another. But
I was going to ask, how about faith, and where does that come into the picture? Do you all feel like people are more likely to believe in paranormal activity if they are a person of faith or if they aren't?
I don't think you have to be a person of faith to be interested in the subject. I do think that what faith you have can influence how you respond to experiences and how you respond to discussing experiences. So we've had a lot of people who say, I don't believe that. I am of, you know, this religion, and we don't believe that. Or I'm of this religion, and if you're messing with that, you're dealing with the devil and it's all demonic. And then there are others that embrace metaphysical experiences and lift those people up as, you know, these people are somehow on a higher spiritual level. So it really depends on all the different faiths out there, exactly which one you're coming from.
And Nelson, you're an atheist, right?
Yes.
So how does your faith or lack of faith kind of intersect with your kind of creating space for the possibility that there is paranormal activity?
I don't necessarily think that, you know, paranormal activity is tied to religion. I've actually had a lot of conversations with people when you mention that you do paranormal investigations, they kind of get turned off. I think a lot of them from those conversations feel like maybe it would disprove their beliefs, which I think is actually complete opposite, potentially. But the important thing when you're doing this is, regardless of what your faith is, if you're going to have that critical thinking mindset, which is very important, you need to leave all of your biases behind. And so whatever your beliefs are, you need to table that. And when you're reviewing any of the data, try to see, well, without taking that into consideration, what could be happening.
Is it hard to transition from doing that work to going back into the real world? You both have day jobs. How much of those two identities come together for you?
I spent a lot of time trying to keep those identities separate.
Okay.
And then I was working at a different job about 7 years ago, and WRAL put our group on one of their segments, and because we were the group that had the contract with the city for Moriki Historic Park. And I told my boss, and she sent an email out to the entire company. So at that point, I wasn't a secret anymore, and I've embraced it, which has actually helped me to be able to write the book, because you can't put yourself out there like that without just saying, okay, this is who I am.
How about you, Nelson?
Actually, I've gotten some training at work that kind of ties into some of this. I do Lean Six Sigma Process Improvement, and it's a lot of it is critical thinking and continuous improvement and doing the whole scientific method of analyzing a problem. So I actually get to use that while I do this. But I haven't, it's not something that I hide from anyone. I don't necessarily broadcast it. But I think lately most people know that this is what I do in my spare time. It takes up a lot of weekends and a lot of nights. Because when you do these investigations, if you're spending, for example, 6 hours at one place, you lay out 10 cameras and you've got audio recorders. When you go back home, for each one of those, it's another 6 hours that you have to spend to review all of that data. So there's a lot of work involved.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but we do have a colleague here on the State of Things who has had some paranormal experiences in this building. So I'm wondering briefly if any of you are sensing any interesting energy in the studio or in this building.
I am not, but it's because I have my walls up right now.
Because okay. I'm trying to focus. Because you're trying to focus on doing this interview. How about you?
I don't have the senses that Nikki
has. And you don't have all your tools with you. Okay, so that's going to be a mystery that we're not going to be able to solve today, unfortunately. Thank you both so much for joining us. Nicole Morrock is the Vice President of the National Society of Paranormal Investigation and Research. Also the author of Please Don't Call Me Psychic, Stories from My Paranormal Knife. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Nelson Noss is the executive director and co-founder of the Ghost Guild Incorporated. You can see Nikki Morrock at a book signing on 3rd Street Social in Wendell on Monday, November 4th. You can find details about the Ghost Guild and everything that Nelson does at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we will talk about our relationship with death. Stay tuned, please.